When you watch a rocket like the SpaceX Starship lift off into the air on a giant stream of fire, you are witnessing the pinnacle of modern-day science and engineering coming together to power an object the size of a skyscraper high into the sky and beyond the Earth. The rocket engine is an important piece of technology today, just like it was 100 years ago and even 1,000 years into our past. Rocket engines have evolved right alongside human society, and we can draw a line that tracks that evolution straight through from primitive beginnings to interplanetary travel. The origins of rocket technology trace back to 9th century China. Ancient scientists were experimenting with chemicals like saltpeter, sulfur, and charcoal in an attempt to create gold or reverse aging. Instead, what they accidentally discovered was the first rocket fuel, a black combustible dust that you might better know as gunpowder. But the Chinese didn't make guns, they made rockets. By the time of the Song Dynasty, around the year 1000, this explosive mixture was weaponized into something the Chinese called fire arrows, bamboo tubes filled with gunpowder and attached to arrowheads. When ignited, these devices generated enough thrust to send arrows flying further than any conventional bow. The critical innovation came when the Chinese learned to harness the explosive thrust of their gunpowder rocket engines. By sealing one end of the bamboo tube and leaving the other open, Song Dynasty engineers were leveraging the same physics that would make Sir Isaac Newton famous many centuries later. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, meaning that escaping gases from the open end of the bamboo will generate thrust in the opposite direction. These primitive rockets were unstable and uncontrollable, but they did manage to demonstrate the core principles of rocket propulsion that would carry over into the modern day. During the Ming Dynasty period, between the 14th and 17th centuries, rocket technology matured into multi-stage systems. The Chinese called their new invention the waterborne fire dragon, and it was described in an ancient military manual as a large bamboo core rocket about 5 feet tall with a carved wooden dragon's head for a nose cone. There were 4 smaller rocket engines strapped to the sides of the body, and on top of that was a second layer of rocket engines to act as a second stage. After the initial boosters burned out, the secondary stage ignited automatically, extending the range and accuracy of the rocket. After the second stage had burned down, it would trigger a cluster of arrows to shoot forward out of the dragon's mouth. This design is remarkably similar to modern multi-stage rockets like the Russian Soyuz, and the Ming Dynasty Fire Dragon was able to fly over 1.5 kilometers. Even with the ingenuity of these ancient Chinese rocket scientists, they were limited by the gunpowder fuel that was available to them. It lacked the efficiency and consistency to power a long-range or high-altitude rocket. It would take until 1903 before rocket engine technology would advance again. A Russian schoolteacher named Konstantin Tsiolkovsky would become the founding father of modern rocketry. With his pioneering rocket equation, Konstantin proved mathematically that spaceflight would require liquid-fueled engines with high exhaust velocities. In his liquid-fueled rocket design, you would need 2 propellants, a combustible, and an oxidizer. There are many combustible liquids available, but in order to liquefy oxygen, you need to make it very cold, what we call cryogenic temperatures, as in below negative 180 degrees Celsius. That would have been very difficult to achieve in 1903, but electricity was expanding rapidly across the globe, and the required technology would be quick to follow. The next thing you need to make a rocket engine work is a source of pressure. You need to force the liquid propellants from their tanks and into the combustion chamber where they can be ignited. Higher chamber pressures will result in a stronger force of combustion that burns up the fuel more completely. And the final element of the rocket engine is the nozzle. The byproducts of combustion, the exhaust gas, will naturally flow from areas of high pressure to low pressure. So the vast difference between the small high pressure environment of the combustion chamber and the wide low pressure area at the tip of the nozzle will cause the exhaust gas to flow rapidly in that direction. You also need a mechanism to help you steer, but we'll get to that in a minute. Constantine's most important work, The Exploration of Cosmic Space by Means of Reaction Devices, proposed liquid hydrogen and oxygen as optimal propellants, introducing multi-stage rocket designs, and advocated for gyroscopic guidance systems. Two decades later, on March 16, 1926, American physicist Robert Goddard would launch the first ever liquid-fueled rocket in Auburn, Massachusetts. Powered by liquid oxygen and gasoline, his 3-meter-tall vehicle flew for just 2.5 seconds, reaching 12.5 meters altitude. It wasn't much, but it was a good start. Goddard would rapidly innovate on his design and along the way would invent critical rocket engine technology like regenerative cooling, which circulates fuel through the walls of the engine to prevent meltdowns. He implements the first gyroscopic stabilization by placing movable fins below the engine nozzle to direct the exhaust plume. Goddard was also the first to create pressure inside his engine by using a fuel pump. So instead of relying on a pressurized tank to hold the propellant that would rapidly depressurize once released, the fuel pump maintained a consistent flow of propellant from beginning to end. By 1935, Goddard's rocket surpassed 2,300 meters in range by using modular designs with separate upper stages, just like the Chinese had done centuries before. Sadly, in his own lifetime, Goddard was not regarded highly as a father of the rocket engine. Instead, he was brushed off as little more than a hobbyist, but his patents would go on to become cornerstones of later US and German rocket programs. Speaking of Germany, Hermann Oberth's 1923 book, The Rocket into Planetary Space, would inspire a society of amateur German rocketeers. Among them was a young man named Werner von Braun, who was experimenting with liquid oxygen and alcohol-fueled engines that could achieve far more power than any design that had come before. Von Braun's first significant invention, the V-2 rocket, was deployed by the Nazi army in 1944 and would become the first long-range ballistic missile. The engine burned a combination of cryogenic liquid oxygen and 75% pure ethanol. This generated 25 tons of thrust, enough for the V-2 to reach a velocity 5 times the speed of sound. Von Braun's revolutionary design included a new cooling system known as film cooling. This injects liquid ethanol through tiny holes in the walls of the combustion chamber, creating a protective layer around the metal. The V-2 engine also used a complex new fuel injection system with 18 separate nozzles. This ensured stable combustion by precisely combining fuel and oxygen streams. Von Braun also improved on Goddard's fuel pump system. He invented the first gas generator, essentially by taking a small amount of the rocket's propellants, igniting them in a miniature combustion chamber. The exhaust gas from the generator would spin a turbine, which would power the fuel pump. With this innovation, the V-2 pumps delivered 125 kilograms per second of propellants by spinning at 5,000 RPM. The V-2 engine had a burn time of just around 68 seconds, but that was enough to reach altitudes of over 200 kilometers, making it the first man-made object to reach outer space. The biggest limitation to the V-2 design was the ethanol fuel. It was very hard to make. The Nazis had to process 30 tons of potatoes into alcohol just to launch one V-2. In the aftermath of World War II, captured Nazi rocket technology would kickstart missile development around the world. The Soviet Union managed to get their hands on V-2 hardware and design blueprints, while the Americans took von Braun himself and many of his co-workers. The next great leap in rocket technology would come out of the Soviet Union in the late 1950s, a result of their reverse engineering of V-2 components. The R-7 rocket was initially designed as an intercontinental ballistic missile, but would find its true purpose as the world's first orbital rocket, a machine that would launch the first human satellite and put the first man into space. The engines powering R-7 were revolutionary. A new design created by Soviet engineer Valentin Klushko, each of the 4 side boosters had an RD-107 engine, while the rocket's core was powered by an RD-108. For propellant, the Soviets had solved a key problem of the V-2 by swapping out the alcohol fuel with kerosene, which was much easier to mass produce. Glushko also had an innovative solution to scaling up the power of the rocket engine to new heights. By increasing the size of the combustion chamber and engine nozzle, you're just making a bigger, hotter fire that's taking out an even faster hurricane of exhaust gas. Things can become very unstable, and even a little bit of instability in a big engine will lead to disaster. So, Glushko takes the main combustion chamber and he breaks it up into four smaller chambers, each one with a small engine nozzle. So, when you combine those together, you actually get more power with greater stability. He also had every combustion chamber running off one common turbopump, so he wasn't making the engine four times more complex either. Glushko also invents the Vernier thruster to help guide the rocket. These are miniature rocket engines attached to the side of the main engine, and they can be swiveled back and forth on a mechanism that directs their thrust to steer the rocket. The RD-107 and 108 also implement von Braun's gas generator cycle. It diverts 3% of the propellant away from the main combustion chambers to power the fuel and oxygen pumps. The exhaust from the gas generator is then dumped out of the engine. This is not the most efficient design because we're losing 3% of the total energy in the fuel, but it is reliable and effective. Over on the American side, the newly formed NASA is scrambling to match the capabilities of the Soviet R-7. American rockets of this era were basically just extensions of the V-2 design. They hadn't figured out a way to evolve the rocket engine like Glushko. NASA's boosters were small, underpowered, and unreliable. But there was a space race and the Soviets were winning, so Americans played their ace in the hole. They brought Wernher von Braun and his old colleagues out of retirement and set them on a new task: build a rocket that will put men on the moon. And that's exactly what they did. For the Saturn V moon rocket, von Braun and his team would build a monster, the F-1 engine. It remains to this day the biggest and most powerful single-nozzle rocket engine ever flown. Von Braun wasn't interested in embracing Glushko's multi-chamber approach. He was going to build one epic combustion chamber with a nozzle so wide you could park a Jeep inside it. And then he was going to strap five of these engines together to create the Saturn V booster. In early hotfire testing of the F-1, the engine would violently tear itself apart. This was caused by powerful oscillations in the exhaust gas, waves of air pressure that would push and pull on the wall of the nozzle. It's like how an opera singer can break a wine glass with their voice. So the biggest enemy of the F-1 was combustion instability. Glushko was right about the negative effects of building a bigger engine, but NASA was determined to figure it out. The solution had more to do with acoustics than rocket science. The engineers built in a series of finely tuned baffles and resonators into the structure of the engine that would control and direct the flow of exhaust gas, in the same way that the precisely carved wooden body of a violin renders vibration from the strings into a beautiful musical tone. The body of the F-1 rendered explosive chaos into raw, concentrated power. Another very important, but often overlooked innovation on the Saturn V was the J-2 engine. This powered the rocket's second and third stages after separation from the colossal booster segment. The J-2s were fueled by a combination of cryogenic liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, the same propellant mixture that our old friend Konstantin proposed back in 1903 as the ideal rocket fuel. And he was correct. The J-2 was not a high-thrust monster like the F-1, but it was ultra-high efficiency. Once the Saturn V had built momentum and cleared the Earth's atmosphere, these two hydrogen-powered upper stages would provide all of the energy required for an express trip from Earth orbit to the moon. Of course, the Saturn V rocket was highly successful in its goal of landing men on the moon, but its career was short-lived. By 1972, the F-1 was retired, and nothing like it would ever be built again. But the hydrogen-fueled innovations of the J-2 would live on in NASA's next big project, the Space Shuttle. Getting a space shuttle into orbit was no easy task. While conventional rockets like the R-7 and the Saturn V had started out on the ground with humongous boosters underneath, the portion of the rocket that actually went into space was relatively small. With the shuttle project, NASA was trying to get a very large space plane into orbit, and it had to be capable of reaching high altitudes to deploy big, important payloads, like the Hubble Space Telescope. The shuttle needed a blend of high thrust and high efficiency, and to solve that, the rocket lifted off under the power of two very different engine types. Strapped to the sides were two solid rocket boosters, the most primitive of all rocket engines. This concept goes all the way back to China and the Song Dynasty. It's just a big tube filled with flammable powder. They put a cap on one end and a nozzle on the other, then you light it up and hope for the best. Inside the shuttle orbiter itself, there was a significantly more modern propulsion system at work, the RS-25 hydrogen-fueled rocket engine. We are now entering a post-Von Braun era of NASA, and this new engine will become the American workhorse for the next 3 decades of human spaceflight. There were several challenges to overcome with the RS-25. It had to operate both at sea level on Earth and in the vacuum of space. It needed a throttle control to manage the velocity of the winged orbiter as it ascended through the atmosphere. Unlike a straight pointy rocket, you can't just go full force when you're essentially flying a plane straight up. And most of all, the rocket engine needed to be reusable for the first time. While every other rocket booster ever made had simply been dropped from space to plummet into the ocean or crash into a desert, the shuttle would come home for a landing. So its engines needed to be able to fly multiple times without requiring a whole lot of maintenance. This is where hydrogen fuel really shines. When you burn kerosene, you end up with a lot of soot as a byproduct, and that doesn't matter in an engine that's going to be dropped into the ocean, but in a reusable rocket engine, you don't want it to come back full of gunk that needs to be scrubbed out. Hydrogen burns clean. The only byproduct of combusting hydrogen and oxygen is water vapor. This also allowed the RS-25 to implement the very first closed-cycle gas generator. On previous engine designs, like the Soviet RD-107 and the American F-1, the gas generator that powered the fuel turbopump had an open cycle, meaning that the exhaust gas powering the turbine is dumped overboard. This is done for simplicity, and it's also done because soot from the gas generator would rapidly clog up the system and the engine would fail. So with clean-burning hydrogen, you don't have to lose 3% of your fuel just to run the pumps. That exhaust energy can now be contained in a closed-loop system. This maximizes efficiency, and it increases the combustion pressure inside the engine, which increases the thrust-to-weight ratio. This keeps the RS-25 small enough to fit 3 of them into the tail of the shuttle orbiter. There was also enough room in the tail section to install a hydraulic gimbal system that could change the angle of each engine individually. By angling the thrust from the engine, you get a higher level of steering control as the orbiter ascends. It would be decades before rocket scientists could figure out a way to evolve the rocket engine beyond what NASA had done with the RS-25, and that is where SpaceX comes in with the Starship Super Heavy rocket and its Raptor engines. Raptor would have to be an exceptional engine in order to deliver on Elon Musk's grand vision for Starship. The rocket would need to carry massive amounts of crew and cargo into space, then fly to the planet Mars, land on Mars, refuel, and then fly all the way back to the surface of the Earth and land again. To accomplish this, the Raptor would need to check every box all at once. The raw power of the F-1, the reliability of the RD-107, the efficiency of the RS-25, and all of that capability would have to be wrapped up in a compact package that would allow for mass production on a scale that the rocket industry had never seen before. NASA built 5 functional space shuttle orbiters, each with 3 engines. SpaceX wants to build 1,000 starships with up to 9 engines each, and in addition to that would be hundreds of Super Heavy boosters, each one carrying 33 engines of their own. SpaceX engineers leveled up the Raptor by introducing the first ever full-flow staged combustion cycle engine. So, just like the shuttle, it uses a closed-cycle gas generator to power the fuel turbopump, except Raptor has 2 gas generators, and each one powers a separate turbopump. One for fuel, and the second for oxygen. With the twin-turbo setup, Raptor is able to drive even more pressure into the combustion chamber than ever before. the F1 engine generated around 100 bar of pressure in its combustion chamber using one open cycle gas generator. That means 100 times more air pressure than what we feel on the Earth at sea level. The RS-25 brought that up over 200 bar of pressure with a closed cycle gas generator. Then the SpaceX Raptor version 2 with dual closed cycle gas generators has brought that up to over 300 bar of chamber pressure, which is equivalent to being 3,000 meters deep underwater. In addition to that, SpaceX brought in a new fuel source, methane. The reason that SpaceX moved away from hydrogen fuel is because there is no natural source of pure hydrogen. It's a very reactive atom, so it's always going to be found stuck to another element, so you have to spend a lot of energy to unstick it. Typically, we do that with water. We break it apart into hydrogen and oxygen atoms using a large amount of electricity. Methane is what happens when four hydrogen atoms cling to one carbon atom, CH4, so it's very similar to pure hydrogen, and there are vast amounts of methane gas trapped under the surface of the Earth. We know it better as natural gas. Millions of people use it for heat and cooking every day. All you have to do is make natural gas so cold that it turns into a liquid, and you get a very powerful rocket fuel. You can also make methane on the planet Mars. The atmosphere is full of carbon and the surface is full of frozen water. Combining the two together will give you enough methane and oxygen to refuel a starship and fly it home to Earth. So with each evolution of the rocket engine, there was always a motivating factor. Sometimes that was making more powerful weapons to win a war. In other times, it was done to win a space race and land on the moon. In the modern day, rocket engines are evolving to help spread human life to other planets of the solar system. But at the core of even the most advanced rocket science, we are still just lighting fires to push things forward. This is still primitive stuff, and we have so much room left to grow.